Hello, my name is Rachel Tromelin. I'm an assistant professor of physical therapy at Louisiana State University. Today I'm on to host a podcast about persistent postural perceptual dizziness. We are really lucky today to have Dr. Neil Shepherd and Janine Holmberg with us. I'll have them introduce themselves and then we'll get started on the questions. First, Neil, I'll have you introduce yourself.
My name is Neil Shepherd. I'm a consultant at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. I'm an audiologist by training, although I've spent the last basically 40 years working primarily with vestibular patients and a lot with not only assessment but also treatment aspects and management of vestibular disorders. Janine?
And I'm Janine Holmberg. And I am the coordinator of Balance Rehab at the Intermountain Hearing and Balance Center in Salt Lake City, Utah. I've been working with dizzy patients for the last 20-plus years and working on expanding their treatments and lecture around the country just on the subjects of dizziness and vestibular rehab.
Great. Well, thank you guys both for being with us today. I'm really excited to host this podcast on this disorder, which I think we've all sort of felt in our guts has existed for a while, but now it has a name and now it has some description to it. So let's start out with what is persistent postural perceptual dizziness and how did this evolve from a disorder called phobic postural vertigo?
Well, to start with, let's clear up the confusion in that chronic subjective dizziness, CSD, and the 3PD that you just named are exactly the same thing. It's just a name change being put forth by the a group from the Barony Society in an effort to do international classification of vestibular disorders. So They're exactly the same thing. There's no difference between them. So either 3PD or SCD is a disorder that, if you will go through the criteria for it in just a bit, but it really has its origins, if you think about, you were saying that things, you felt like things have been around for a long time. Starts back about 150 years ago. So it has been around for a long time. Actually, there was multiple literature that described individuals that have chronic dizziness, a motion sensitivity, along with anxiety and a variety of phobic behaviors. And the original term, interestingly, was agoraphobia, which has transferred over to other things throughout the years, but it was because this was described for people that had these types of symptoms in open places, marketplaces, primarily busy marketplaces. Phobic postural vertigo was introduced in the German literature in 1986 and 10 years later into the English literature. And it was a syndrome that was defined as postural dizziness with fluctuating unsteadiness provoked by environmental or social stimuli. So they gave examples like crossing bridges, going downstairs, not upstairs, but going downstairs, walking in busy streets or walking in crowds. Typically, this was triggered by either a vestibular disorder, medical illness, or other psychological stressors. Further studies found this to be actually the second most common disorder diagnosed in the German population behind benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, at least for adults. And it was typically associated with obsessive compulsive disorder and vegetative disturbances. And it was found to be, with studies, at least a reliable diagnosis. The development of what we're talking about today, chronic subjective dizziness, CSD, or the 3PD version of the name now, actually started in the early 2000s and was introduced with three specific features, and that was persistent non-vertiginous dizziness that was going on for greater than 3 months, hypersensitivity to self-motion, external motion, visual surrounds, and a difficulty with what we call precision visual tasks, such as reading. This definition didn't derive directly from claustrophobic vertigo, but was highly influenced by that, together with work from a couple of other groups looking at space motion phobias and Bronstein's work in England, primarily with what's called visual vertigo. So that's where all this starts and comes from.
Good. And so, speaking of the diagnostic criteria, what is the diagnostic criteria and what would be the main signs and symptoms of 3PD?
The primary diagnostic criteria are still very much the same as they were when they were first introduced, other than with the now inclusion of postural involvement. And so they involve, one, a persistent sensation of dizziness, unsteadiness that would go on for 3 months. And this many times, even though we call it non-vertiginous, this many times will involve a sensation of self-motion, a sensation in their head of movement, but it's hard to define. They can't define the trajectory, but a sensation of movement in the head. So those are the primary symptoms, but they're persistent. They need to be there at least 50% of every day, if not 24/7, and go on like that for 3 months. Second, they develop a situation where the symptoms increase with postural changes. So typically when they go from lying to sitting, they'll notice more when they're sitting. When they go from sitting to standing and standing and walking, they'll notice them more when they're standing and walking. And then thirdly, the development of sensitivity to a variety of visual stimuli. And this usually involves itself with complex environments, stores, malls, places like that. Visual patterns, especially when they're walking over surfaces with a variety of visual patterns. The focused visual tasks, which usually involve itself with reading, especially reading on a computer when you're scrolling, or nowadays we ask about reading on a handheld device like your phone, things of that nature. They also will be sensitive to visual motion. If they're sitting still, not moving, but if they're watching other things move, that also will increase their symptoms. And lastly, head movements. So those are the criteria that we look for when we are thinking about the possibility of them developing 3PD. Now, in terms of signs, really, in many cases, there aren't any. If you look at the laboratory studies that are done, VNGs, ENGs, things of that type, for a good percentage of these patients, they're all normal. When you test them in a formal way with postural control, with the devices that are out there, there now seems to be, when we can go back and look at large populations of these, patients that have more difficulty with simple tasks coming back into a relatively normal range when the task becomes more difficult. And those are many times referred to or have been characterized as aphysiologic, and yet we see that with these types of patients. When we look at the laboratory studies that go along with the vestibular assessment, because probably good two-thirds of these patients develop this from a neuro-otologic event that starts things down the road. So something like vestibular neuritis, labyrinthitis, occasionally we'll run into patients with Meniere's disease with this. You certainly can have findings on VNG, ENG. Usually they're all peripheral findings. They all have a tendency to show perhaps a hypofunction. But of importance, these findings are also shown to be well compensated or fairly well compensated. We also find that one of the precipitating factors for many of this are people that start with spontaneous events secondary to migraine, and so they have diagnosed vestibular migraines. And vestibular migraines themselves can give you a lot of abnormalities on the ENG-VNG. The point is that there's no specific pattern to laboratory studies that is going to indicate this as a specific disorder. It really takes off from the history that you get from the patient's symptom.
And I know from the patient perspective, from the patients that I've seen with this and chronic subjective dizziness, that can be very difficult for them to understand. Because I think a lot of times physicians are looking for testable things they can see, abnormalities on VNG or abnormalities with postural control. And when they see nothing, they tell these patients, oh, well, you're fine and nothing's wrong with them. But the patients still say, well, I don't feel right and something's wrong with me and the doctor doesn't believe me or they feel like I'm making it up. And I think that only exacerbates things and makes the situation worse.
You're definitely right. It certainly does do that. And if they try to tell them that, oh, well, maybe you ought to see a psychiatrist, most of the patient's first reaction is, I'm not crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just thinking it's all in my head. Well, it is in your head, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is the approach to this, when you counsel patients with recognition of this, if it's done properly, they're very accepting.
Yeah, and usually what I do, I know, unfortunately, there is a stigma against counseling, and even though we all could agree that there should not be. And I usually will use some humor with my patients, and especially when I'm asking them in the interview, do you have any anxiety and depression? Instead of coming out and saying, well, do you have anxiety, depression, or other things, I'll say something like, you know, if I had a nickel for every patient who came in who was a little bit nervous or depressed or anxious with these symptoms, I could retire on an island at the age of 38 and never have to work again, that it's just so common. And have you noticed, and I can imagine how one day you're fine, the next day your world's spinning around you and you don't know what you did, that must be really, really upsetting. And then I feel like that really lays a nice groundwork, not to that I'm saying you're crazy and there's nothing wrong with you and it's all in your head.
Right. We approach it very similarly in that the whole concept of fear and anxiety reaction is usually what sets up the parameters around which this develops. And there isn't anything more powerful in giving you a fear anxiety reaction than the first time you have a disconnect with your environment because you're dizzy, because you're spinning, things of that nature. That's why the majority of these seem to start first with a neuro-otologic insult of some type. And so with that, if those symptoms continue and they don't reverse themselves, then they can become conditioned on it. So a conditioned situation is one that we use for analogy for this. The other one is the fact that when you have problems with dizziness, you go through a natural a defense mechanism where you start to immediately reduce the amount you'll let your body move. And you start to pay way too much attention to what's going on visually around you. And if those don't reverse, then they come back to haunt you to help develop these types of symptoms.
Mm-hmm. And I do this a little bit. I feel like I tell the patients all the time and I tell my students that I kind of play Dr. Phil. Like, it's all about changing the negative tape in your head and making it positive. That usually patients will associate a certain movement with symptoms and then that's negative because I get dizzy and dizziness is bad. But once I explain to them the mechanism of habituation, I'd actually say, if you do something and it makes you dizzy, instead of thinking it's bad, think Rachel would be happy you just did an exercise and then that's what's going to help me to get better. So then they start to associate that dizziness symptom with positive. If I do this, this is something that I can control to make myself better.
Right.
Janine, do you have anything to add to this, Janine?
As far as with respect to the diagnostic testing or?
Either diagnostic testing or managing some of these psychologic states.
What I see with my CSD patients, my 3PD patients, is that I do just have to go through, and very often the testing that's been done, I explain it to them. I very often explain just what you're talking about, that incredible response that can happen with an acute vestibular problem, and that it's very definable, that a good majority of people with definable inner ear problems go on to develop this. And I will often tell them, 40, 60% of patients can develop this, and it's just almost, I try to get them to view it as a complication to to their healing, a known complication that could happen given the intensity of the initial provoking event, and that fear and that has developed and the behavioral conditioning that's developed.
Okay, good. So in all the difficulties with the fact that there's not a lot of testable signs and you're making the diagnosis a lot of times based on history, how does one make a differential diagnosis of 3PD, and what are some disorders which may present similarly, and how do we differentiate 3PD from some of those disorders?
Well, the ones that get confused with this, interestingly enough, vestibular migraines get confused with this a lot, even though when people present with these persistent symptoms, if they have headaches, if they're a definable migraineur, people associate, okay, the migraines are causing this. This is vestibular migraine. The definition of vestibular migraine is very different from the definition that we just went through for 3PD or CSD, in that vestibular migraines do not produce constant symptoms. Vestibular migraines produce episodes, spikes, events that are fairly discrete in nature, and in many cases can be on top of this, but that's not what's causing it. So that one clearly separates itself out. Mild debarkment is another one that can get confused with this because of that whole issue of most of the patients, if they describe a motion, they describe it as rocking, and they describe it as a persistent rocking. That's fine. That's what mal de debarkement also typically gives you, except for the fact that your symptoms are usually significantly worse if you're sitting or lying still with mal de debarkement. Whereas for most of the patients that we have, they describe their symptoms as worsening as they go to stand and walk. Now, both groups certainly can have a reduction in symptoms if they're in a moving vehicle. For the 3PD CSD group, they're fine if they're in a moving vehicle as long as they're not looking out the side window and things of that nature, which also have a tendency to differentiate it. Beyond those, then you get into some issues of health-focused anxiety, where that can come into play where it will produce symptoms for a patient. Health-focused anxiety is where the patient is hypervigilant about their entire health issues. They try to wrap everything up into one diagnosis and then try to relate what's happening to them back to the sensation of dizziness. That's a little hard to tease out, but it is something that many times we think it's CSD, and actually individuals like Dr. Staub and some others that are well versed in this, when they actually take a good psychological history, come away with the fact that, this is probably a health-focused anxiety, or somatoform disorders. You can have people that will have somatoform disorders that sound very much like this. Those distinctions really need to be taken care of by a psychiatrist who knows those areas. So that one's not too critical, because they overlap enough that if you think it's CSD, the treatment may still be the same. Medications that would use by a psychiatrist could be different.
Okay. Speaking of medications, are there any medical interventions for this disorder?
Yes. And in fact, what we do is when we talk to patients about treatment for this, we always tell them there are two components. One is the possibility for the use of medication. And those medications typically start out with SNRIs, so the selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. Usually it's Effexor or venlafaxine is the one we go to first. We will use Cymbalta occasionally. In terms of, if those don't have the effect we want, or if the patients can't tolerate them, then we move into the SSRIs. And Zoloft is one that we'll use. Prozac is one. Lexapro gets used occasionally. Celexa and Paxil, we typically do not have a tendency to use those very often, but they can be. And so those are medications, and we tell them that the whole purpose for the medication is to try to dampen the symptoms that they're experiencing on a daily basis and start to try to break up the 24/7. But that's only one component. The other component is the use of physical therapy in order to try to drive down the sensitivities to the various visual stimuli and head movements that are feeding this disorder in the background. There are situations where, under review, the decision will be made, now let's just start with physical therapy. There may not be a need for medication. If we can get the symptoms down from the standpoint of the sensitivities, the other may dwindle away, and if that's the case, then we don't have to worry about the medication. So we will do situations where we use physical therapy, not medication, but there's never the reverse. Whenever they're put on medication for this, there's always a physical therapy component.
Yeah, and I know, and Janine can maybe comment to this, I know personally, you know, knowing how long it takes the SNRIs and the SSRIs to really work, that at least four to ideally six-week time frame to work, and that sometimes it's really hard to kind of be patient with the PT interventions to sort of give a chance for the medications to work. I don't know, Janine, if you have anything to add and some tips and what you would do in that period.
As far as after we start the treatment?
Yeah, like once, you know, if it's diagnosed and the medications are started, but they do take about 4 to 6 weeks to really ramp up and start working, how to kind of bide your time in the PT interventions until those medications really kick in?
You know, there's a huge amount that actually can and should be being done at that point. These patients are kind of ramped up in their fight or flight system. They are not attending to balance cues in a correct way, and there's a huge amount that can be done getting patients to actually identify the amount of tension, their fight or flight responses they're doing, just even as they're standing, getting them to be what we call proprioceptive aware. They very often, when your body goes into a defense mechanism, it tends to want to overutilize visual cues. Plus, that's something that the inner ear problem might have triggered to begin with, the over-reliance on visual cues. So we can start very, very early and very importantly getting them to start attending to proprioceptive pathways, starting to dampen this visual dominance that's kind of feeding itself, and getting them to be aware of what is the resources available for them to stay stable and how that's going to decrease, you know, the feeding of this disorder, and that's going to start leading into what they have to get to very quickly is the fact that the dizziness, the things that are causing them dizziness, whether it be going into a grocery store, looking at something that's moving, if we can find a way to dose it appropriately, it's going to be the thing that's going to heal them. And that's a very, very important concept for them to start to understand, because up to this point, everything that's made them dizzy, they've perceived as something that's bad, that's going to make them worse, and so they start avoiding the very thing that's going to make them better. And so that concept can be done extremely quickly and needs to be done extremely quickly to start getting that kind of change in attitude and how they're going to experience things and how that the dizziness could actually be something that's going to be something that if we could dose it right and if we could do it gradually enough and that they can link that with appropriate balance, awareness, and stability, they're going to be able to retrain themselves. And this powerful concept that this learned behavior can be unlearned and that they can learn to start to get their balance and their motion perception to be normal.
So, Janine, what items should be included in the physical therapy exam of a patient that you suspect may have 3PD?
So number one, you have to realize that 3PD can be something that's a diagnosis of exclusion. So even if you find a past history, like significant for BPPV, you have to be watching what I like to call what is driving their disability. You know, they may have discreetly describing what sounds like BPPV, and perhaps when you do your testing, you either find BPPV that maybe accounts for their positional symptoms, but it may not account for the fact that they haven't been leaving their house for the last 3 months, that they haven't been doing their computer work because it's causing them dizziness. And so we need to really, as Neil kind of stressed, we need to listen incredibly carefully to these patients. We need to listen to what is provoking their symptoms, how long is it lasting, what environments are provoking it, what is driving the disability, and can we make sure we're addressing, not only from a treatment standpoint, but from the patient's understanding, what symptoms can be accounted for by the BPVV, what can be accounted for by something that goes beyond the ear. And so when I examine a patient with this, number one, I need to make sure I'm checking very carefully for their tolerance. So when I'm doing my normal Smith Pursuit saccades, not only am I looking for the quality of that, but I'm also looking for the tolerance of that. How much is that provoking symptoms? How long does it take for it to calm down? I'm going to need to, for sure, take a look at, you know, what is going on with dynamic visual acuity. And very often I'll find that their dynamic visual acuity is actually fairly normal. I mean, it's a 1 to 2 line drop, but yet they're sensitive to it. And if I see that the dynamic visual acuity is normal, you know, I'm not going to be pushing a VOR times one paradigm really heavily. I'm going to be pushing things where I'm going to be addressing the fact that they didn't tolerate that test. And so addressing my exercises more from a habituation standpoint, meaning they're staying in control of their symptoms, they're giving a long enough rest period between things, they're staying intact with their balance control while they're doing this. And so it's a total different shift from what I do with my unilaterals, where I'm pushing for the error signal and I'm getting them to drive the speeds up higher and I'm getting them to try to focus. And so it's a very different shift in what is the focus of the exercise, and I would for sure need to be doing something for motion sensitivity to document what exact motions are they sensitive to, how intense does it provoke, and how long does it last. You know, if you're watching them do it, are they disconnecting with their balance system at the same time? Are they going into a fight or flight? Is their breathing changing? Is there, you know, is there autonomic responses that are going on? And so a lot of it is they will do these motions and they'll disconnect. You'll see their balance decline. You'll see sway increase. You might even see a functional component or almost an aphysiologic type behavior when they start to do some of these things. And so it's a very different focus. For sure, I would want to be quantifying on some kind of visual, either a visual analog scale or a subjective rating scale, how intense are the very specific different motions that are causing them problems. So I want to quantify very specifically, is it horizontal, is it pitched, is it, you know, is it visual tasking, what is it, what environments? And I very often use the visual vertigo analog scale, if I can say that correctly. And I can actually go through, because it's not only going to be what I provoke in my clinic, it's very often environmentally induced. So I'll want to quantify how bad are the grocery stores, how bad are escalators, how bad is driving, under what circumstance, how bad is it walking across the patterned floor on the carpet. I'm going to be wanting to capture that and be able to monitor that for both my prescription of what I'm going to be exposing them to and then also being able to document their progress. And I can tell you one of the things we have to do as therapists is in a very systematic way show them evidence that what they're doing is making a difference, that when you experienced this, when you focused on the correct thing, when you didn't go too long, you had a different outcome with what happened. I'll definitely look at the dizziness handicap inventory, particularly some of the less motion-provoked ones, more the functional, emotional overlay that I'm looking at on the dizziness handicap inventory. In my clinic, I'll also want to be looking at something like the hospital anxiety and depression scale, just some measures to take a look at. Is their system really ramped up in the anxiety fields and into the depression fields? Because we certainly know anxiety by itself can cause shifts in the way the sensory balance system is processing. And so that all the stuff that you're going to do in therapy in the examination is going to lead you to a very specific exercise prescription and a very specific balance progression. When I do the clinical test for sensory interaction balance or the Foehman dome or whether it's posturography, if you have the high tech, I'll be looking particularly at what's happening in conditions 3 and 6. And even if I'm doing the low tech version, you know, there's a tendency right now to throw out condition 3 and 6 in the low tech version because we don't have good standardized ways of doing it. But I'll actually have things like a busy field that I'm going to be putting around them. I absolutely want to be looking for what is the difference between eyes closed and what's working and what's happening when I have visual conflict, because that's very often something that's going to be something that I'm going to need to address specifically in the balance retraining.
Okay, good. And besides some of the other outcome measures that you already mentioned, would there be any other that would be appropriate to use? One of the ones you were talking when you were talking about the measures which came to mind would be the motion sensitivity quotient.
Yes, and that's exactly would be one of the key ones that you would need to do, the motion sensitivity quotient, because you need to define which motions are it, how intense is it, how long does it last. And so the MS, you know, the motion sensitivity quotient would probably be one of the bigger ones that needs to be addressed.
And what I really liked about what you said was that you want these nice objective numbers that you can show the patients their change over time and that they're actually getting better and that they actually have some control over their symptoms.
Yes, very, very much. And the feedback is priceless, you know, to show patients changes on posturography, to show patients the numbers of their MSQ, to show patients the changes in the VAS intensities is going to be very, very powerful.
Besides,
this becomes very,
oh, go for it, Dr. Shepard.
Yeah, this becomes very important because the length of time that we're looking at potentially having an impact is extensively longer than you would with a unilateral hypofunction. You mentioned that 6 weeks to ramp up the meds. Well, actually, we take more like 2.5 months to get the meds up to a normal therapeutic dose, because one of the problems is these specific meds that are used for helping to control this, they're all for anxiety and depression. And the first side effect when you start any of them is you increase anxiety. So you have to take it quite slow. So typically we talk about 3 to 4 months of a very slow progressive therapy program together with a very slow progressive medication program in order before they actually start to see or appreciate any change. So because of that extensive period of time, being able to show change becomes quite important.
Definitely. Besides some of the other PT interventions that you talked about, Janine, are there any other interventions that are beneficial for these patients?
So there'd be a number of key ones that we usually start to utilize just even in the clinic. First, treatments are very often something either done with an umbrella, where they're actually viewing something that's moving, or a striped cloth, sometimes catching and throwing a ball. So very often we'll start with something that's sitting, that's very stable, and they have to start viewing this object. And we want to try to keep them under the point where they get too much secondary symptoms, or even the dizziness escalates too much. In fact, kind of use the word, I want you to make this uncomfortable, but I'm hoping that you can keep this going for maybe a minute or two, and then we're going to build that up. So it starts with just some visual tasking very often. Very quickly, and even maybe on the first visit, we go into store prescriptions where they're actually going into the stores, and they're very often, they're counseled to kind of go for as much time until their symptoms elevate by 2 or 3 points on a subjective rating scale. They take a rest break, just like you would do with habituation, settle the symptoms back down, go again for a second interval until your symptoms ramp up, and then rest it, and then work your way back out of the store. So you're kind of doing 4 different intervals, and then you're gradually going to be building this until we want a goal of that they can start being able to tolerate this environment for up to even 20 or 30 minutes. So you're approaching it from kind of getting them to feel empowered to provoke some of the symptoms to a point where they can control them and de-escalate them, and then gradually build that time to longer and longer. We very often can also use what we call the VR cancellation, or what's being called in the concussion literature, kind of visual motion sensitivity with getting them to be able to view something and do a VR cancellation exercise. Again, with this very heavy focus on can they stay connected to their balance, can they feel empowered to be able to de-escalate their symptoms at an appropriate time, and make sure that the dose is never too heavy and that the postural demand is very carefully and slowly brought back up. I see too many times where vestibular therapists throw cushions, eyes closed, rapid head motions at these people, and they will lose them very, very quickly. We will also move into fields where we start getting them to look at YouTube, busy visual environments, where, and a lot of my 3PD patients have a full YouTube list of progressively worse symptom viewing patterns where they have to view them, keeping their symptoms under control. And sometimes this can actually be used. If I can't get my patients directly into the store, this could actually be kind of a bridge to get them into the store where they're actually in their home. They're showing, they have perfect in-tuneness with their balance and their proprioception, and they're letting themselves view these busy environments at progressively longer and longer, trying to feel the sense that their, you know, their breathing isn't changing, their muscle tension isn't changing, their focus on their the calmness with their balance is not changing. And so there's really this, you know, can you, and it's almost like this game, I get the patients to say, can you stay attentive to the calmness, to the balance pathways that are intact while this vision is going in front of you, to the point where you're almost feeling like this is just blowing over you and it's not, you're not assigning the significance and you're learning to almost distract from it and stay connected with your balance. So those would probably be, and then I do a lot of balance work where they're moving into more eyes closed work where they're just very, very comfortable with proprioceptive work. And I'm very, very sure, I make sure that I don't take away ground cues too fast. I do not get them on cushions too soon. I do not get them narrowing their base of support too soon. They're basically staying in positions where they're very in control and taking away the vision. And then, and as if I do something where I narrow their feet, meaning kind of a standard exercise where you narrow the feet into a tandem or heel-toe position as their eyes are closed, that goes very slowly with these patients because we're getting them to, we know that they have the response to do this. They just, they need to connect with it. They need to find it. They need to be confident with it. So it's developing the confidence with the balance skills as you start to take away the vision and then as they start to expose themselves to the desensitization with the vision.
Okay, great. Dr. Shepherd, anything to add to that?
No, she covered it very well in terms of the things we do. We, like she mentioned, with the store walking, we also do it with the umbrella. We actually use it in a format like habituation. So in some cases, if they can't tolerate, say, moving the umbrella for very long at all, we have them do the same thing they do in the store walking. They'll spin it just until they get a perceptual increase in their symptoms, then stop, let it settle, and then do it again for 2 to 4 repetitions. So we hold to that. If they can do it longer, then we can actually do it by timing as opposed to a number of repetitions.
Okay, great. So what are some appropriate physical therapy goals and what would be the time frame for the intervention and also the dosing of these interventions that you talked about?
Neil was talking about how this is something that's going to be happening over very often 3 to 6 months at a minimum. Dr. Staub, you know, has been quoted as saying to his patients, I want you to reclaim your life over the next year. As far as specifically what I'm doing is physical therapy, as far as the dosing, very often these patients are seen infrequently. Even if they live next door to the balance center, I would not want to see them any sooner than 2 to 3 weeks, maybe even between the interventions. So they have plenty of time to build a lot of habituation and control. And I want them focused on the fact that they're the ones that are making this better, what they do every day, how they allow themselves to expose themselves to motions, how they're getting themselves back out. And so I want that sense that they are in control of this. And then they come to me to help them with the guidelines of how do I increase the intensity, how do I increase what's going on next. And so if they need a lot of proprioceptive work, meaning they're not connecting to their balance very quickly, sometimes I'll do a weekly appointment for a couple of weeks to get the initial prescription. But once the initial prescription's in place and they're giving me, they're able to start doing some good visual motion exposure, it should be every 2 to 3 weeks, maybe at the most. I tell them that I want to see them perhaps 8 to 12 times over the next 6 months. And we may be done sooner than that, but I give them the expectation that this is going to get better over months of time, not days to weeks, and that this is something that you know, their system has become sensitized to something, and we have to go out this, you know, gradually so we keep the fight or flight system kind of out of the system. The goals that I have for them is very often related to patient-specific goals. You know, are they going to be able to get back to the grocery stores? Can they get back to exposure to motion that, you know, and I may set something with respect to the posturography, meaning can they start showing better balance when their eyes are closed? Can they start showing better balance when they're exposed to visual motion? But very often one of the goals is, you know, they will be able to go shopping if computer exposure is one of the things they don't do. So I try to keep it very patient specific and with respect to their rating scales and everything with that.
Okay. Dr. Shepherd, anything to add to that?
No. He just had to step out.
Okay. I was just going to ask you anything else that you think is important to know that we didn't talk about already.
I'm trying to think. I think it was covered really well as far as, you know, as far as the distinct dose, you know, as I think of, you know, habituation versus adaptation. You know, adaptation, you're always pushing for these 1 to 2 minute intervals. Habituation is in small sets. With these patients, we're very often looking to go for that 1 to 2 minute interval, but like Neil said so beautifully, it's within them always feeling controlled of their symptoms. So I'm not pushing, like with my unilaterals with neuritis, I'm pushing, you know, you've got to go for the 1 to 2 minutes. We've got to get that error signal. But with these patients, yes, I'm going to eventually working for them being in a visual motion exposure of 20 to 30 minutes, but that might be something that's 6 months away. You know, if I, you know, they're keeping their symptoms, basically they must control their symptoms. They must know how to de-escalate them. They must have a confidence that they're feeling this and gradually exposing it and taking control of getting longer and longer exposures. So the prescription is going to be very much that habituation. Do the dose till it gets to a certain level. Bring yourself back down. Do that in 3 to 5 repetitions, 3 to 5 times a day. And then we will be doing something where we're moving them into being uncomfortable for longer, longer intervals till we can get them to that 20, 30-minute exposure, which is really my goal. You know, can I get them to where they can shop for 20 to 30 minutes? Can I get them, you know, being able to feel those environments for longer, longer intervals, which would be the end goal that I would want. And that I would want their posturography or this, you know, the sensory balance to be very normalized, the transitions from eyes open to eyes closed, transitions from firm to soft surfaces, and then again into the vestibular environment where there's soft surface with eyes closed. But a lot of that's going to be just as they can control their symptoms. So symptom management and this concept of de-escalating and surface orienting and proprioceptive uptraining is very heavy with these people. And to try to get them to, you know, to really feel in tune with what their, I usually call it their assets. In fact, when I finish their examination, I very often give them a list of all the things that were normal in their exam. Did you realize your coordination's good? Did you realize you can feel the tuning fork through my, you know, through my hand? Or, you know, did you realize that all of your vestibular testing is very normal? You have a very good ear. In fact, it might be kind of ramped up right now because your fight or flight system is so keyed into motion. And so for them to feel this integrity that it's almost like I give them a way and a reason for why they can and should heal, because they have all these systems that are intact. They have so much that they haven't been tapping into. And so they have a reason for why they can heal and get out of this.
Okay, great. And one of the things I really liked what you said was your role more as coach and advisor, and that the patient is doing most of their work on their own. And I think especially I came to a vestibular rehab after being a therapist for maybe 2 to 3 years. And when you think about the general model that a lot of us were taught, it's like we're doing the hands-on and we're the ones in charge. But the way I see physical therapy in general moving is that we are going to move more to that consultant and coach role when you look at reimbursement and in the modern healthcare environment and everything that we do. And so I feel like vestibular therapists are certainly on the edge of this.
Yeah, yes,
I would agree.
Okay. Dr. Shepherd, anything to add, any final thoughts of things we haven't talked about already that you think we should add?
No, the only thing is, how well does it work? Do we have any data to show that? Mm-hmm. And at this point, we have one preliminary paper that was just accepted to Journal of Vestibular Research, looking, and it actually has some of the first data on how do these patients work with vestibular rehab. And the results were positive from that. They found the physical therapy visits, independent of the exercises, the physical therapy visits and the education quite productive. They did find a significant percentage of the patients did find a reduction in their visual sensitivities, improvement in postural control based on their own perception of it as an improvement. And so it's just a start. This was with patients with and without comorbidities. So this was a very mixed and very, very difficult group. They were all CSD, but they had other comorbidities. In general, we typically look at the fact that probably 60 to 80% of patients that go into this program of medication and therapy, after about 3 to 4 months, do express the fact that their symptoms are reducing. There's a small group for whom they actually are gone, but that's very small. But the important thing is that they're improving. But there is a group, there are a group of people out there for whom, even though they look just like this because of their comorbidities and some other things going on, they are in that other 20 to 40% where even after 6 months, we're still dealing with them.
Okay, great. Well, thank you guys for this wonderful podcast. I think there are some very, lots of very valuable information for therapists out there working with these patients. And I would certainly tell everyone to keep a heads up for this paper in Journal of Vestibular Research. I think that'll be a great reference for people going forward.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you guys again.